When you picture Thailand, what comes to mind?
Right.
Like, for most of you listening, you probably immediately think of a booming regional economy, right? You picture a global tourism hotspot, you know, incredible beaches, the bustling street markets in Bangkok, and this massive, highly efficient logistics hub that basically connects mainland Southeast Asia to the rest of the world.
Oh, absolutely. It's an undeniable economic powerhouse.
Yeah. But our mission today is to look at that exact same picture and, well, flip the negative. We're going to explore the dark side of that exact same infrastructure.
And it is a really fascinating duality to observe, because the reality of transnational finance is that efficiency is completely agnostic.
Right.
I mean, the world-class banking systems, the high-volume commerce, the incredible transport links that make a country a beacon for global trade, those are the exact same tools desired by highly sophisticated criminal networks.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They want fast payments and smooth logistics just as much as a legitimate tech company does.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the core concept leaping out of the sources today is this word convergence. We aren't talking about, you know, a local street gang running a neighborhood racket.
No, not at all.
We're talking about a highly sophisticated, interconnected financial crime economy. We're looking at a scenario where Thailand acts as a source, a transit point, a destination, and a financial interface, and sometimes all of that at once, for the exact same criminal operation.
Yeah, and understanding that convergence is just crucial for anyone in the financial sector, or really anyone trying to grasp global risk right now. For financial institutions, the question isn't whether Thailand is uniformly high risk across the board.
Right, it's not a blanket thing.
Exactly. Blanket de-risking, where a bank just refuses to do business with an entire region, is actually a really lazy, ineffective approach. The real challenge is understanding exactly where and how those legitimate systems are being hijacked.
Which specific customers, which trade corridors, and which financial products are creating exposure to this hidden economy? So to understand what that modern threat looks like, I think we have to start with the historical one and look at how it's mutating. Because the geography of Thailand places it right next to the Golden Triangle,
which is historically one of the most notorious illicit drug production zones on the planet.
Right.
Right where the borders of Thailand, Laos, and Myanmar meet.
Right. And according to Thailand's 2022 National Risk Assessment, narcotics are flagged right at the top for money laundering offenses. But what really stood out to me in the source material is that Thailand itself has largely eliminated its own domestic opium cultivation.
Yeah, the domestic cultivation is mostly gone.
So the problem isn't what's growing in the ground there anymore. It's the logistics network. Myanmar is currently producing industrial-scale methamphetamine. We are talking staggering quantities of meth, heroin, ketamine, and all the precursor chemicals required to make them. And it's all flowing through the region.
The logistics involved are just massive. I mean, criminal networks are utilizing commercial trucking, maritime routes, small border crossings, hidden cargo. And they are highly adaptive.
Right. They pivot fast.
Very fast. When law enforcement puts pressure on a major river route, the syndicates just simply shift to the roads. When a major port is locked down, they move to smaller, informal border crossings. They rely on this localized ant traffic, where individuals carry small amounts across daily.
It's like building a state-of-the-art superhighway for trade. You really can't be surprised when bad actors decide to drive on it, too. I mean, they have to pay for precursor chemicals, transport, protection, storage.
Exactly.
And to do that, they launder the proceeds through cash-intensive businesses, property, gold, and cross-border trade. So if you're an investigator, you're looking for unexplained cash deposits or logistics payments that just do not match a customer's declared agricultural income.
That's the traditional red flag, yes.
But I have to push back a little here. Because drug smuggling, moving dirty money through a cash business, I mean, that is a tale as old as time. Didn't the source material say the landscape was recently completely reshaped?
It did. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, you're absolutely right. I mean, the drug trade is massive, and it acts as a primary predicate offense, meaning it's the foundational crime generating the dirty cash that needs washing.
Right.
But the seismic shift in the region's financial crime landscape is digital. Hmm. It has been entirely reshaped by industrial-scale online fraud across the Mekong region. We are talking about scam centers operating in neighboring jurisdictions that have essentially industrialized human deception.
Industrialized deception. Wow, that is a chilling way to describe it.
It is, unfortunately, the most accurate way. These centers operate like grim corporate campuses.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're using highly scripted social engineering, fraudulent investment platforms, impersonation of government officials, and these long-term romance scams to target victims globally. And Thailand's world-class communications infrastructure, its borders, and its financial system sit right at the intersection of how these operations recruit people, transit data, and ultimately get paid.
Which brings us to how they actually move all this stolen money without getting caught immediately. Because obviously you can't just wire $2 million from a romance scam directly into a cartel's corporate bank account.
No, that would trigger an alert immediately.
Right. So they have to hijack the banking system from the inside out. And they do it using human conduits, mule accounts.
The entire financial infrastructure of this cyber scam boom is built on the backs of mule accounts. Some people open them willingly, some are deceived by fake jobs, and others are completely coerced.
And the scale of this is what absolutely blew my mind. The numbers coming out of Thailand's Anti-Online Scam Operations Center and the Bank of Thailand reported that in 2024 alone, commercial banks suspended approximately 1.75 million mule accounts.
It's incredible.
1.75 million in a single year.
It is a staggering volume. I mean, to put that in perspective, that's thousands of fraudulent accounts being identified every single day. And it highlights a fundamental shift in how institutions have to fight this. You can't just wait to flag an account after a victim calls in crying that they've been scammed.
By then, the money is gone.
Exactly. The money's long gone. Detection is shifting from just analyzing a bank account in isolation to analyzing the person, the human behavior, and the network behind it. Financial institutions are now looking for shared devices, shared IP addresses, overlapping contact numbers, and very specific rapid cash out routes.
Because if you just close an account, the network replaces it tomorrow.
Right. Account closures alone do not disrupt networks that can recruit replacements that quickly. You really have to map the network. But there is a much darker layer to this mule account epidemic, which relates to how these accounts are sourced and how the scams are actually run.
Yes. And here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, quite tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Thailand has historically been a source, a transit point, and a destination for human trafficking, usually centered around labor exploitation in industries like fishing, agriculture, or construction.
Yes, historically.
But this data highlights a completely new dimension, the scam economy.
Yeah. People are being recruited under the guise of legitimate employment. They answer ads for tech support or sales roles.
Right. They think it's a real office job.
Exactly. And they are often transported through Thailand into neighboring countries, stripped of their passports, locked in compounds, and literally forced into conducting these online frauds at gunpoint or under threat of violence.
Which brings up a massive paradox that I couldn't stop thinking about when I was preparing for this deep dive. Let's say a bank detect suspicious activity. They see a mule account receiving stolen funds, they shut down the account, and they report the user to law enforcement. Aren't they potentially punishing a trafficking victim?
That is the big question.
Right. Like someone who is literally being held captive and forced to open these accounts or run these scams. How do you possibly police that from a compliance desk in London or New York?
It is arguably the most difficult evidential question in modern financial crime. Because the same individual on paper can be both a participant in suspicious transactions and a victim of horrific exploitation.
It's wild.
Yeah, and this is why financial institutions are really trying to implement what's called a victim-centered approach.
But what does that actually look like in practice? How do you tell the difference on a spreadsheet?
Well, the goal is to untangle the organizers from the exploited labor using behavioral data. You aren't just looking at the money flowing in from the victim of the romance scam. You're looking at the financial footprint of the scam center itself.
Okay.
So imagine an investigator looking at a cluster of accounts. They might see indicators like a standard salary-like payment being deposited into a worker's account, but then 30 seconds later, that entire amount is rapidly transferred out to an offshore crypto exchange.
Huh.
Or you might see 50 completely unrelated workers all listing the exact same shared residential address or the same employer phone number.
So you're looking for signs of unusual employer control.
Exactly. You look for recruitment fees being paid or remittances that make zero sense for the supposed tech job they were hired for. If a bank just blindly auto-closes an account because it touched crypto, they might actually be severing the only financial lifeline or the only investigative breadcrumb to a captive victim.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. It's really about distinguishing the ultimate beneficiaries of the crime from the people whose physical labor and identities are being exploited.
Okay. So you have millions of mule accounts, you have industrialized cyber fraud, and you have physical drug routes generating billions of dollars.
Mm.
The criminal organizations running this need highly sophisticated ways to legitimize that kind of wealth so they can spend it in the real world.
They absolutely do.
And this brings us to the shadow enablers.
The systems and structures that obscure the true nature of the funds. And you just cannot talk about these enablers without addressing corruption.
Right. It's widely documented in the sources that Thailand scored 33 out of 100 in the 2025 Corruption Perceptions Index, ranking 116th globally.
Yeah.
I just need to pause here for you listening.
Okay.
We have to be super clear. We are not taking a political stance here. Left wing, right wing, whatever. We're not endorsing the political implications of that index.
Right. We are just looking at the data.
Exactly. We are simply reporting the exact same raw data that global financial institutions use to gauge their risk exposure when they're scrutinizing things like public procurement, licensing, and natural resources.
And having that context is vital for understanding the mechanics of money laundering, because corruption acts as the ultimate shield.
Yeah.
It protects or enables all the other crimes we've discussed, the trafficking, the natural resource exploitation. But how do the corrupt officials hide the proceeds of that bribery? They use legal persons, they hide behind nominee shareholders, rapid director changes, and deeply layered corporate ownership.
A nominee shareholder being basically a local person who gets paid $50 to put their name on the company registration, so the person actually pulling the strings remains invisible.
Exactly. And this creates a huge challenge regarding politically exposed persons, or petees. A bank cannot just rely on registration records if the behavior, the funding, and the decision-making suggest a powerful official is secretly in control.
Because the paperwork is basically fake.
Right. PEP controls have to be evidence-led. It's about rolling up your sleeves and finding the actual source of wealth and the true commercial rationale for a transaction, not just making assumptions based on a piece of paper.
So alongside those corporate structures, the analysis points heavily to underground financial services, specifically illegal gambling and crypto.
Yeah, illegal gambling is a massive predicate offense in Thailand. And the shift to online platforms means operators can serve millions of customers remotely, and they settle bets through bank accounts, e-wallets, and digital assets.
And a digital casino seems perfectly designed to launder money for other crimes. I mean, it's like a massive digital blunder.
It really is.
You throw in cartel drug cash, human trafficking crypto, and a bunch of legitimate player bets. They all get converted into casino chips, spun around at high velocity, and when it's cashed out, it all pours out looking like the exact same legal gambling winnings.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. You have this high transaction velocity, round value transfers, and thousands of unrelated counterparties sending money back and forth.
Yeah.
And regarding cryptocurrency, Thailand's Securities and Exchange Commission actually strengthened its frameworks in 2025 to restrict unlicensed foreign platforms from targeting Thai users. So licensed operators now have strict anti-money laundering obligations.
But the criminals aren't using the heavily regulated exchanges, are they?
No, of course not. Criminals simply adapt. What's fascinating here is that crypto isn't inherently suspicious, but they move to offshore exchanges, peer-to-peer trading networks, stable coins, and crucially, unhosted wallets.
Let's define an unhosted wallet for the listener, just so we are all on the same page.
Sure. Think of a standard crypto exchange, like a digital bank. They hold your funds and ask for your ID. An unhosted wallet is simply software on your own personal computer or a physical USB drive.
Okay.
It is completely outside the control of any regulated exchange. It's the digital equivalent of a duffel bag full of cash. The risk spikes when investigators see rapid wallet hops, meaning funds jumping through multiple unhosted digital wallets in a matter of minutes.
Oh, to deliberately break the chain of traceability.
Exactly. Especially when those wallets ultimately connect back to known scam networks or those mule accounts we discussed earlier.
And beyond the digital world, we also have to touch on the physical movement of goods. Trade-based money laundering. Thailand has a huge manufacturing base and incredible deep water ports. We are seeing criminals moving illicit wealth through the disguise of wildlife, timber, or precious stones using phantom shipments.
This is where the paperwork itself becomes the crime. You might have a shipment of electronics that is valued at $1 million on the invoice, but the actual goods inside the container are just cheap scrap worth $10,000.
So,
the remaining $990,000 is illicit value being quietly transferred across a border under the guise of a routine, legitimate trade payment.
So relying purely on a shipping invoice is like trusting a magician's diversion. If both the buyer and the seller are in on the trick, the paperwork is just an illusion. But how does a bank actually catch that?
Financial institutions have to test the economic reality of the trade. And this goes far beyond checking boxes.
Right.
If an investigator sees a shipping manifest for 50,000 tons of timber, they don't just look at the price. They might pull up satellite imagery.
No way, really?
Yes. They look to see, does the receiving company's registered address actually have a physical warehouse big enough to hold 50,000 tons of wood, or is it just a tiny storefront in a suburban strip mall? Does the shipping route make any economic sense? That's what testing economic reality means.
And while the shadow economy we've talked about so far is largely driven by profit, those exact same blind spots in the supply chain, the phantom shipments, and hidden corporate layers there being exploited for ideological motives as well?
Yes, this raises a very important question about terrorism and proliferation financing. Terror financing in the region tends to be more geographically concentrated, particularly around the southern border insurgency, utilizing cash, charities, and small front businesses.
Right.
Meanwhile, proliferation financing, which is basically sanctions evasion and the movement of materials for weapons programs, exploits those trade blind spots.
Talking about dual-use goods, right?
Exactly. A dual-use good might be a highly specialized civilian water pump or a drone motor that looks entirely legitimate for a commercial factory.
Right.
But it can easily be repurposed for a nuclear enrichment program or a military guidance system. Combating this requires firms to understand not just who their customer is, but the ultimate end use of sensitive materials. And those risks can hide in low-value, commercially ordinary-looking transactions.
So what does this all mean? We have mapped out this sprawling, interconnected, transnational criminal web. We've got industrial meth, human trafficking for cyber scams, 1.75 million mule accounts, corrupt nominees, crypto blenders, and phantom timber shipments. If I'm listening to this, I'm wondering how on earth any bank or government can possibly fight it.
It is a really daunting picture, but there is a clear blueprint for building resilience. It requires a sophisticated six-layer control stack for financial crime leaders to actually disrupt the specific convergence of threats.
Let's break those layers down organically, because obviously the first step can't just be block every transaction from Southeast Asia.
No, it starts with a hyper-specific, localized risk assessment. That's layer one. You have to target the specific high-risk sectors, the specific border provinces, and the exact payment corridor that are being exploited.
Precision over blunt force.
Mm.
But even with a precise focus, we just talked about how criminals hide behind fake nominee names. How does a bank actually pierce that corporate veil?
Which brings us to the second capability, layer two, reliable ownership analysis. Due diligence teams have to punch through those shell companies to identify the ultimate beneficial owners, the people actually pulling the strings and reaping the profits, regardless of whose name is on the local registration.
And to do that at scale, you would need an incredible amount of data.
You need integrated intelligence, which is the third layer. You cannot silo your data. You have to merge mule account data, scam reports, device indicators, and cyber intelligence so that it feeds directly into your daily transaction monitoring.
Right. It has to be connected.
If an IP address or mobile device is compromised by a scam center, the transaction monitoring team needs to know instantly.
But criminals are smart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you block an IP address, they just spin up a new one. Or they use a different mule.
And that is where network analytics, specifically graph-based investigations, become essential as the fourth layer. Criminal groups recycle everything to save money. They reuse the same mule accounts, the same mobile devices, the same addresses, and the same unhosted crypto wallets.
Oh, I see.
Graph databases allow investigators to visualize these connections. Imagine a giant digital spider web on a screen where you suddenly see that 50 supposedly unrelated customers all log into their banking app from the exact same residential Wi-Fi network.
Wow.
It allows you to find the single operating network hiding beneath what looks like thousands of separate customers.
Okay, so that covers the digital fraud side. But what about the physical side, the fake timber shipments we talked about?
That requires risk-sensitive trade and payment monitoring, our fifth layer. That is the satellite imagery check we discussed earlier. assessing the customer's actual physical capacity, the pricing of the goods, and making sure the incoming and outgoing funds actually make sense for the business they claim to be running.
And if you find all this out a week too late, the money's already gone.
Which is why the final layer, layer 6, is rapid response. Time is everything. Institutions need lawful information sharing, 24-hour fraud channels, and procedures that allow them to freeze funds and preserve evidence before the money crosses a border and disappears into an unhosted crypto wallet.
So what does this all mean for the financial leaders on the ground? Are we just counting how many accounts get closed? Because we already established that closing a mule account just means they open a new one tomorrow.
That is the ultimate takeaway here. Effectiveness cannot be measured by the sheer volume of alerts or the number of accounts closed. That is a false metric of success.
Right.
True effectiveness is measured by the number of criminal networks entirely disrupted, the actual funds recovered to victims, and the quality of the intelligence generated for law enforcement. It is about converting your legal powers and your data into sustained disruption of the organizers at the top of the chain.
Not just playing whack-a-mole with the exploited laborers at the bottom. Wow. Okay, to summarize this journey for you listening, we started in the jungles of the Golden Triangle, tracing physical drug routes that have plagued the region for decades. But we saw how that same illicit infrastructure has mutated, leveraging the digital age to create an absolute nightmare of 1.75 million mule accounts, fueled by human trafficking and shielded by corrupt enablers, crypto blenders, and phantom trade. The sheer complexity of Thailand's financial landscape is breathtaking, but so is the six-layer defense required to fight back.
It really requires a fundamental shift in perspective. You are no longer just tracking money. You are tracking the digital and physical behavior of transnational syndicates.
Precision, network analytics, and testing economic reality are the only ways to see through the illusion. Which brings me to a final question, setting up something for you to chew on after you finish this deep dive. We've talked about how these transnational criminal groups are currently operating with the agility of tech startups. I mean, they share legal entities, they share digital assets, they share specialized money launderers across borders. Looking ahead to the next evolution, what happens when they take the next logical step?
That is the arms race of the next decade. If these syndicates are already this efficient manually, what happens when they start fully automating these interconnected networks with artificial intelligence?
Exactly.
Think about it. If an AI can generate the social engineering scam, manipulate the victim through a deep fake, instantly open the mule accounts, and execute the rapid crypto hops all in a fraction of a second, will a six-layer institutional defense run by human analysts be fast enough to catch an algorithmic money mule?
Something to keep in mind the next time you picture that state-of-the-art superhighway of global trade. The cars are getting faster, and some of them don't even have drivers anymore. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly complex deep dive. Keep questioning the hidden structures behind the global economy, and we will see you next time.